happen in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Starting your day with a fresh look at what's happening in town, Texarkana Talks is an interactive show where we talk about the issues that affect you. Here's your host, Zach Ratliff.
Good morning.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. It's Tuesday, everybody, 7:06. I'm glad to be with you. This is Texarkana Talks on 107.1 The Patriot. Man, I just like the way, I like the ring to that, you know? All right, if you want to, you can follow along at ktfsradio.com, or you can download the Texarkana Media Center app. And, you know, if you want to stream the content, if you want to listen on the radio, if you want to follow up on the podcast, however you want to do it, whatever completes your heart's desires. Hey, at the about the 20-minute mark, about 7:20, whenever we come back from the first break, I'm going to have John R. Young on the show. He's written a book about the Kennedy assassination, and we've had him on before. But, you know, with the new information coming out from the unredacted files that have been released, just thought we'd get an update. I mean, there's nothing more fascinating, to me anyway, than the Kennedy assassination and everything around this. So that's what's coming up a little bit later in the show. Welcome back to 107.1 The Patriot. I'm Zach Ratliff. It's 7:24 on your Tuesday morning. Glad to be here. Glad you're with me. Thanks for making me part of your routine. I've got John R. Young on the phone. Good morning, John. How are you?
Good morning, Zach.
So John, just for you all that know, wrote the book titled The End of Innocence, The Assassination of John F. Kennedy. All right, John, you've been on before, but with the declassification of more Kennedy files, it's an exciting time for me as someone who I've been to the sixth story or the museum and I've done the walk, and this is an exciting time for me. So are you finding interest in this new release?
Oh, man, Zach, let me tell you, it's been a whirlwind the last few days since these files were released. And I've heard people in the national media say there's nothing new in the files and it's just a nothing burger. The people who are saying that don't really know so far what we've seen in these records. First of all, I doubt there's any way anyone has read all 80,000 pages. This is going to take weeks, if not months. They're a tough read. There's no search engine. Some are handwritten notes that are not very legible. They're in no kind of order on the National Archives website.
And on that, you know, I was going through them, looking through them, and yeah, you can't be like, they don't come out and say, hey, the CIA did it. It's just all jumbled in there, if not making it harder to find the way it looked to me.
Yeah, I tell people this all the time, the Kennedy assassination was a giant puzzle. Just imagine getting a 10,000 piece jigsaw puzzle and just throwing it out on the table and saying, okay, here you go. And that's kind of what it is. And you just got to kind of put bits and pieces together. And by the way, despite the fact that President Trump, and I'm a Trump guy, but despite the fact that President Trump said there would be no redactions, there are a ton of redactions. Yeah, I think that kind of still somewhat shows who holds some power in Washington, you know. But with that being said, this is still a very significant release. It's the biggest release we've had since the 90s. And frankly, I believe there's a bombshell in there. I've been looking at these records in the last 4 or 5 days, along with some research colleagues, and we found a pretty convincing fact pattern that shows that CIA counterintelligence could be responsible for Kennedy's assassination. And I haven't said that before in 35 years of research. But documents that I saw over the weekend really kind of confirmed that impression. One of the documents released is a 1975 behind closed doors testimony before the Senate Committee of James Angleton, who was a CIA counterintelligence chief. And this document, in conjunction with other Angleton documents, you know, we've seen released in the last 5 years, indicate that Angleton actually was recruiting Lee Harvey Oswald as a CIA source or contact. That's actually the phrase that's used in the documents. That's not a phrase I'm making up.
He was recruiting him before they knew why they were going to use him, but the CIA was already trying to get this guy to come on board.
Yeah. I mean, you know, people try to convince you, and, you know, people in the national media and other authors that, you know, have made a ton of money off selling books, and I'm not one of them, by the way, but, you know, they try to convince you that Lee Harvey Oswald was just a loner and nobody, and that's far from the truth. I mean, this guy was a very intelligent individual, was stationed in Aosugi in Japan, and the Marines were the, you know, top secret spy. U-2 flights were going on. I mean, they were using him for multiple things. But
so this is Lee Harvey Oswald we're talking about. So you're saying he was intelligent. Yeah. He was able to do all these things. He wasn't just some quack that they've made him out to be.
No. And the documents show that James Angleton, again, the CIA counterintelligence chief, monitored Oswald's movements, his political contacts, his personal life, for 4 years, from 1959 to 1963. The document says that Angleton had a 180-page file on Oswald on his desk when the president was assassinated in Dallas.
Oh, wow.
So
he wasn't...
Is there a smoking... No. I mean, is there a smoking gun? No. I mean, it's not a smoking gun. But there is a fact pattern, not a theory. And the fact pattern shows that CIA counterintelligence officers targeted Lee Harvey Oswald for recruitment as an agent in 1959.
Man, isn't that wild? And it was before Tucker Carlson left Fox News that he said, hey, I think the CIA had something to do with this. And so this just backs up that statement.
Yeah, I mean, they put him under surveillance for the next 4 years, from 59 to 63. And when the Warren Commission and JFK investigators came asking about it, they lied to the commission. They lied to the House Select Committee on Assassinations.
Right.
They lied to the Assassination Records Review Board.
Well, there we go. All right, I tell you what, John, we'll go to break, then we'll come back. We'll get into some of these lies. We'll get into what's been uncovered and more of the Kennedy stuff. I appreciate you being with us. All right, everybody, this is 107.1 The Patriot. I'm Zach Ratliff here with John R. Young, and we will be back. Welcome back to 107.1 The Patriot. It's 7:34 on your Tuesday morning. I'm Zach Ratliff. I'm here with John R. Young, author of The End of Innocence, The Assassination of John F. Kennedy. All right, John, you were just getting into it for us. You had just told us that now more than ever, it seems as if the CIA had something to do with the assassination, that for 4 years prior to the assassination, they had been following Lee Harvey Oswald and had been, you know, in contact, it seems, and had at least had a massive file on the guy.
Yeah, I mean, so what we've learned so far from the records that have just been released is there was deep CIA involvement with Oswald years before Kennedy's assassination. And then the deception that followed. Like I said, they lied to the Warren Commission about it. They lied to the House Select Committee on Assassinations. They lied to the Records Review Board about it. They've hid it for years. And now we're still looking at these documents and hope there's some other things in the release that ties into this. But there's no doubt in my mind that the CIA was at least complicit in the events that led to the, you know, wrongful death of President Kennedy. I don't know who the intellectual authors of the assassination were. I have my theories, which I think are very good. But we know the intellectual author of Kennedy's death was not Lee Harvey Oswald. That's no. But
he may have just been the trigger, you know, man or the patsy, but he wasn't the idea man.
Yeah. And you know, there's very good evidence that he wasn't in the sixth floor window when the shots were fired, that he was in the lunchroom, and that comes from numerous witnesses that saw him, including one lady who claimed she was giving him change for a Coke at the time shots were fired.
I read that in your book, didn't I?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you did. So, I mean, but what we've learned over the years is that the story of the lone gunman, just some crazy guy who came out of nowhere and no one knew anything about him, you know, that's just not true. And when I say James Angleton recruited Oswald as a source of contact, that's not an inference of mine. I'm quoting from a document that anybody can go on and see now on the National Archives website, where Angleton describes what was the criteria for putting someone on his surveillance program. And he says in this newly classified document, the sole purpose was to see if Lee Harvey Oswald, and he names him, could be recruited as a source of contact. So that shows that the most likely explanation for Angleton, taking interest in Oswald in 59 was to recruit him as a source of contact. And the fact that, he was maintaining surveillance over Oswald for the next 4 years supports that. So, I think my opinion, and I think it's going to come out in more documents, I think Angleton was running a counterintelligence operation involving Oswald. And there's so many things. You follow Oswald's life. I mean, from 59 up to the assassination, it's amazing how they were using him like a pawn on a chessboard and moving him around. Even when he got to Dallas, he was handed off to some handlers, first George DeMorn Shield and then Ruth and Michael Payne, that moved him around on a chessboard. And basically, he was where the CIA wanted him to be, and he was doing what the CIA wanted him to do. And that was for years.
On that point, even in the O'Reilly Martin Dugard book, Killing Kennedy, it's pretty clear that he's, they don't draw the CIA inference, but they definitely point out how much he moves around and how much he bounces around, and they kind of make it seem like that's just due to him being wishy-washy. But with these new facts that you're talking about, that kind of shows that no, he was wishy-washy because these handlers were moving him.
He was not, he was not the guy that history portrayed him out to be. In my last podcast, I just did about a short 15-20 minute podcast on Lee Harvey Oswald, some things of his life, and I dedicated it to his kids, which are still alive and become very successful, adults in society. One's a doctor and one was an author, and I hate it for them because of what history, has portrayed their dad to be, and it's kind of sad for them, and I know they've had to live with it, their whole life, and I mean, they had to change their name and everything because of the ridicule they'd received for years. But I tell you, Zach, another file that I found interesting, and this has made some news in the media, is the Gary Underhill memo.
Now,
it's a memo dated June.
I saw his name in something when I was looking. So yeah, tell me more.
Yeah, in a memo dated June 1967, U.S. Army Intelligence Officer Gary Underhill. And this guy had made a career in Army intelligence and was very close to some high-level people in the CIA at senior levels. The memo states, Underhill left Washington, D.C., quote, very, very agitated, end quote, the day after Kennedy was assassinated, and spoke with several friends, about how a, quote, small clique within the CIA was behind the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Huh. He was so distraught about this. 6 months later, though, Underhill was found either committed suicide by shooting himself behind the right ear, which is extremely difficult considering he was left-handed, but
right.
Or he was killed. So,
another Washington, D.C. suicide.
Yeah, well, imagine that.
Yeah.
But in my podcast a couple of weeks ago, I had a list of kind of what I called, some of the most JFK-wanted documents that I wanted to see and other researchers wanted to see with this release. And, a lot of these documents have never been seen in their entirety by the public, which is a violation, a complete violation of the JFK Records Act, by the way.
Right.
That's something.
Which one was that passed?
In 92.
Right. And it's nothing. And still, they're just now. And like I said, even the ones they're releasing, in the last couple of weeks, they're still redacted. They're still in violation of the records.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and, there's these, and I'm sure you've seen it on the news, there's these 2,400 records that the FBI mysteriously found after Trump's announcement that the records were going to be released. The FBI, suddenly comes on to 2,400 records. Oh, well, we didn't know we had these. Okay. The FBI claims they've turned these over to the National Archives, but I know myself and other researchers have at the archives when these would be released, and so far they haven't answered. But
what do you think, John, and everybody, I've got John R. Young here with me, author of The End of Innocence, The Assassination of John F. Kennedy. John, what do you think, in my mind, let me phrase it like this, I guess, in my mind, the government hasn't wanted to see you to see how involved the CIA was with this, which I believe has led to the not releasing it for so many years. But I don't know. Are there other motives to not release this, or what? You know, kind of, what's your thoughts on this?
You know, after all these years, I mean, there are a few people still alive. One very, very important person that's still alive is Ruth Payne. She lives in a Quaker community in Santa Rosa, California. And her husband, Michael Payne, were basically, they were also working for intelligence. Their tax records, by the way, are still, you know, being held. You can't see them.
Same about Lee Harvey Oswald, too, right?
Yeah, they're still under lock and key. Why we can't see their tax records, I have no idea. I mean, supposedly, you know, the Paynes were just normal, ordinary folks that took in Marina Oswald, you know, and let her and the kids stay, with Lee's wife. That let her and the kids stay with them, you know, in the summer and in the fall of 63, while Oswald was renting a rooming house in Dallas close to his job. But, you know, they've told us for years that they were just ordinary people, and that's just not true. Ruth got him the job at the Texas School Book Depository Building. It was Ruth who found things in their garage after it had been searched that linked Oswald to the shooting of General Edwin Walker in Dallas, you know, a couple months before the assassination. Yeah, there were so many things that they are tied to. But she's still alive, and I do believe that they've protected her, and they continue to protect her, because I think there's things about her that will eventually come out that shows her and Michael were involved in you know, like I said, moving Oswald around the chessboard, so to speak. And I don't know if we'll see anything in these files about Ruth Payne. I really doubt we do, especially because she's still alive. But, you know, they over the years, they've kept things locked away because of certain people in the agency and certain people in Washington that were involved were still alive. But, you know, that's growing further and further from the truth now,
right?
61 years later, so... But, I mean, Zach, there's some files I really hope we get to see. I mean, there are files about an investigation in Miami that took place right after the assassination, where some investigators were questioning possible human involvement in JFK's murder.
Right.
There's a case file of Herminio Diaz-Garcia. He was a Cuban assassin who he had told friends, many friends, actually, years later, that he was in Dallas and he was one of the gunmen. There's the original Orville Nix film, which is another film of the assassination. You know, everybody hears about the Zapruder film, but no one hears about the Orville Nix film.
Right, yeah, the Zapruder film is the one that's so, you know, that everybody sees, right?
Yeah, so guess what happened to this film? It was taken from Nix by the FBI after the assassination. It's never been seen again.
Imagine that.
And it was a view from the other side of the street with the grassy knoll in the background. And it could have, if there was a shooter on the knoll, which many, many people, including myself, believe there was, you know, it might have shown something in that film. So there's
the fence concept, is that where you think the shooter was?
I definitely think there was a shooter there. There's numerous witnesses that placed the shooter there. Lee Bowers, Ed Hoffman. You know, Ed I got to know really well personally and believed his story with all my heart. And so I definitely believe there was a shooter there. You know, what a lot of people don't realize was there was dozens and dozens of people that rushed to grassy knoll immediately after the assassination.
Right.
And was being shooed away by so-called Secret Service agents, people flashing Secret Service credentials. But guess what, Zach? There was no Secret Service in that area.
I remember that from your
after
book.
After the assassination. Yeah. They were all with the motorcade. So who was these people? That's a huge question that's never been answered. Well, and several Dallas police officers encountered these guys.
Right. And what about, I just got a question from a listener sent to me. What about, there's a theory that the driver was one of the shooters. Is there any basis for that?
I don't believe the driver was one of the shooters. I mean, I've seen that, and I kind of think that theory was kind of ridiculous. I mean, you can see on the Zapruder film kind of the reactions of the driver. Now, I will say this, man, the Secret Service, so much of Kennedy's blood is on their hands by things that happened not only that day but the night before. You know, I'm sure many of your listeners have heard they laid out till 3 a.m, a couple of them 5 a.m, at local bars in Dallas and was hung over the day of the assassination. And they were so slow to react. Clint Hill's really the only one that reacted to the shooting. The rest of them just literally froze. The driver hit his brakes, which was complete violation of policy. I mean, the moment they suspected gunfire, the orders were to get the heck out of the area. And instead, they slowed down.
Right.
He even turned around to look at Kennedy twice.
Yeah, that's not his job.
Let me make sure he's dead before I speed away here. I mean, I'm not saying that, but that's almost what it looked like. And there was some blood on the Secret Service guy's hands. I've interviewed Clint Hill, and he just passed away recently. And I'm going to tell you, it haunted him the rest of his life, what happened that day. It scarred his heart. I'm telling you that. I believe Clint Hill was a good fella. And I don't believe he played part in anything that happened. But what happened that day and what he witnessed. And like I said, he was one of the only ones that even reacted to the gunfire. You know, he's the one that climbed on the car and tried to shield Jackie Kennedy and the president and as they sped away. But the rest of them just literally froze and did nothing. And, man, that was not their job at all.
And then, John, and we're running out of time, but didn't you say that you believe there's some communication between LBJ and Jackie after the day after, the night after, or something? Can you go into that quickly?
Yeah, there are letters, and there is taped conversations. And I don't know if we'll see them, because from my understanding, they're in possession of the Kennedy family. There's conversations between Jackie Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, and she basically said, "I want to know who killed my husband." I have spoken to people that's somehow seen some transcripts of that, and basically that's, you know, the gist of what was said. There was way more into it, but I don't know if we'll ever get to see those. Like I said, they're in possession of the Kennedy family, and I don't know if, you know, and your listeners know, but it's odd because the Kennedy family, including JFK's grandson, has really come out opposed to the files being released.
Right. Yeah, I knew that.
So I thought that was strange. I mean, if that was my grandfather, I would want to know the truth of what happened to him.
Absolutely. Well, hey, John, I've got to get out of here. How can people go to hear more from you? What's your podcast called?
It's the End of Innocence, same as my book. The End of Innocence, The Assassination of John F. Kennedy. In my book right now, I've ordered a bunch of books here at the house, and I'm sending out signed autographed copies of the book, the soft cover for $40 and the hardcover for $60. And all they got to do is email me. And my email is endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. If they will email me and say, "Hey, here's my name, here's my address, I'd like a signed copy, and we can arrange, you know, for payment and all that," I'll mail them a signed copy of the book, a personalized copy. So it's something I'm extremely proud of. 514 pages, over almost 1,000 pictures.
Yeah,
so there's a lot of pictures that go. Yeah,
it's an awesome book. I've read it. It's on my bookshelf currently. It's worth reading. John, thank you for being here. I appreciate it. And then as stuff comes up, hopefully we can follow up on it.
That sounds good, Zach. Thanks for having me.
All right, thank you. All right, everybody, it's 7:51. This is 107.1 The Patriot, and we will be back.